Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 23rd of February. Well, one thing is for sure, C-SPAN is probably going to have a very large audience this Thursday. President Obama has now, some would say, why so late, put forward his plan for health care reform. He has asked the Republicans to come with their plan to the Thursday meeting. And the New York Times is saying today that he may have started the process for a passage of the legislation, which is essentially the Senate version with some changes, with only Democratic votes if there is no bipartisan solution. We're going to be talking about health care reform, the big meeting at Blair House this coming Thursday. What exactly is in the president's proposal? Will the Republicans have a written out plan that they will be presenting on Thursday? President's proposal, just to, in case you didn't see this, it's at the White House website. And to summarize, it makes, they say, insurance more affordable by providing the largest middle class tax cut for health care in history. It sets up a new competitive health insurance market, giving, they say, tens of millions of Americans the exact same insurance choices that members of Congress will have. It brings greater accountability to health care by laying out rules of the road to keep premiums down. It will end discrimination against Americans with pre-existing conditions. And they say, and money is certainly an issue here, it will put our budget and economy on a more stable path by reducing the deficit by $100 billion over the next 10 years. Is this a reasonable beginning point for these negotiations on Thursday? Many Republicans have said that the Democrats need to scrap their plan and start all over. We're welcoming your phone calls as we speak with two guests this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. Thomas Miller is our first guest. He is a former health economist for the Joint Economic Committee, studies healthcare policy and regulation. He's a former trial attorney, a journalist, and a sports broadcaster, and has testified before Congress on issues including the uninsured, Medicare prescription drug benefits, health insurance, tax credits, genetic information, Social Security, and federal reinsurance of catastrophic events. He has worked on Social Security reform legislation and organized a number of hearings that focused on reforms in private health care markets. He works for the American Enterprise Institute. Thomas Miller, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Good morning. The president has asked for the Republicans to come on Thursday with a written plan of what they would like. Is there such a plan? Will they come with a written plan?
Well, they're not telling me, but I'd be surprised if there is a single extensive written document that's going to be presented. The president, after all is said and done, as you look at yesterday's proposal, really is offering pretty much the same thing that's been in one version or another of the House and Senate bills. He's willing to compromise by having people agree with what he started out with. They moved some dollars around to deal with a few noisy dissenters, but there's really not much different today than there was a month ago when this couldn't get all the way through Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate. So Republicans have ideas. There are a number of different members who have their own particular take on legislation. But I don't think there's some grand master plan that's going to be the counterweight to what is a very extensive set of legislative details. You can count either 2,000 or 2,500 word pages or more in this type of legislation.
There are some Democrats who are saying, and perhaps some Republicans as well, why in the world did the Democrats, Obama particularly, wait so long to come forward with his plan?
Well, he didn't really come forward with a different version of the plan. I mean, a lot of this is kind of made into more than it really is. The president decided as a legislative strategy to have Congress go first, but what they were doing was largely informed by what he campaigned on, what his basic elements were. There are always some things around the edges where the House disagrees with the Senate to some degree, particularly on the public option and more of a public plan and the taxation of high benefit insurance policies. But this is kind of much ado about nothing. The question is, you know, to be blunt, it's a competition between dumb and dumber, and the president decided to offer dumbest yesterday.
Why do you say dumbest?
Well, it's somewhat the worst of both versions. We sprinkled, depending on, there's not an official CBO scoring of this, so, and we don't have legislative details, which is a small matter that sometimes the dog chews the homework at the White House. They don't get it all done in time. But by some estimates, it's at least $75 billion more than the last, whatever you want to, credence you want to put in the previous scoring of it, for a 10-year cost, which actually costs a lot more when you fully install it. And basically, it catered to the left of center groups in the House who were largely representing unionized labor and other groups that they didn't want any taxation of the most expensive health insurance plans. So they got some money back in return, sprinkled a little more money to the states for the Medicaid expansion. So there's even more federal taxpayer support of that than before, as opposed to the Nebraska deal. It's a deal for everybody, I suppose. And there were a few other things that basically ramped up the squeeze on employers for mandates. So it's not, I mean, the Senate bill had problems in itself. This probably makes it a little bit worse in the perspective of many folks. And you know, the larger opinion surveys, which are always a little, you know, fuzzy, indicate that the general public wasn't crazy about this and more were opposed than for it a month ago. And this hasn't made it particularly any better.
What do you think needs to happen? Do you think in order to satisfy Americans and to satisfy Republicans, the president would have to come forward on Thursday and say, we just don't have enough agreement here. It's not bipartisan. We need to start over.
Well, that would be remarkable. I don't think that's at all the plan or the strategy in the White House or the congressional majority. This is setting the stage to tweak the last version of the Senate legislation to run this through what's called reconciliation so they can have a majority of 51 votes rather mm-hmm. than requiring 60, and cross their fingers and hope, although the votes aren't there currently, to also get that passed by a majority in the House where the limited support for the last bill, which barely squeaked through, has probably gone down a bit and might be hard to run through even to find that majority again.
So you think that the president is thinking in the back of his mind of reconciliation?
Oh, not in the back of his mind. It's in the front of his mind. But they want to put on a show for the folks to say, we tried, we were reasonable, and it was those terrible Republicans who wouldn't agree with it, what we started out with. And therefore, we're left with no other alternative for the good of the American people but to ram this through, whether or not you like it or not.
Well, what about the fact that they did try? They have been working on this for a year.
They certainly did, and they didn't want to take no for an answer.
What about what seems to me to be a major part of this is to cover the millions and millions of people in this country and there, but for the grace of God, go you or me, actually, or anybody who's listening, to get health insurance. Does his plan address this? How would the Republicans address this very important issue to everybody, really?
Sure. Well, it's an important issue. It's not the only issue because we always need to remember that one of the problems is if the cost of health care and the resulting cost of health insurance keeps growing higher and higher, we can't find enough money to pay for it. So that's an equal problem as well. But certainly what's been proposed at different times over the last year on the majority Democratic side, they certainly can cover more people. That's somewhat the easier part if you're willing to collect the money or get it from other folks to pay for it. So the Medicaid expansion certainly accounts for about half of the coverage increase. They don't get universal coverage. You still leave some folks out, depending upon how you want to score it, anywhere from 15 to 20 to 25 million people still would be uninsured. And there are a maze of subsidies and provisions that move the dollars around so that it seems for some people they're getting a deal, but they don't always count the other pocket to recognize how much they're paying for it, either through higher premiums down the road or what are secondary effects by maybe not finding the jobs they used to because their employer can't offer them, or the taxes that someone else initially pays come back to those folks as well. So it's a little bit of a circle game. Now, you're asking what would the Republicans do, and there's different sentiments in that regard. The older move was to essentially change the tax subsidies for health care to make them fairer and distribute them more to people who need help in health insurance so that they're a little bit more steered toward lower-income individuals than higher-income individuals. There are other proposals to deal with those people who find a great difficulty in getting an insurance premium they can afford due to their health status. One approach is to really put some serious money into high-risk pools. Some states do it well, a lot don't, and we need a lot more financial support from the federal government to do that. There are other ways to provide incentives, pretty strong ones, for people to remain continuously insured in order to get the type of protections that we've had in HIPAA for the group market against pre-existing conditions. So there are other ways to go about this, but fundamentally, until we also engage in a lot of reforms that will encourage smarter, more effective, efficient care, and a better coordination of that, and this is on the delivery system side, we're not going to find enough money to borrow from the Chinese or to tax for rich people to pay for all this.
Some Democrats and some Republicans are saying that maybe what we need to do is start with an issue at a time. So that's this incremental approach. We cover the uninsured. We deal with people who have been denied because of pre-existing conditions. One step, another step, another step. Would that be an easier and a better way to go?
Well, it would be a more implementable, politically, possible approach. This is constructed in a way where everything intersects with everything else, is all connected in order to basically run everything through Washington at the end of the day and then have increasing centralized control of healthcare. So sometimes folks will admit to that. Other times they'll say, oh, we're just trying to help a few people here and there. If you pull this apart, it doesn't satisfy the fundamental dream of the designers of this legislation, who really do want very much a highly politicized avenue for healthcare, where you go to the government and you get something in return and you bow down and say thank you very much. So I think it's going to be hard to pull this apart. I think if it was done in that manner, to target folks who most...
Hello? Oh, I don't know where he went. He just phoned us. Whoop! Evaporated. We'll have Connor get him on the line again, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for our guests. We're talking about the healthcare bipartisan big meeting. We'll all be watching C-SPAN or perhaps on cable. Does anybody know whether cable is carrying this as well? Probably C-SPAN is the place to watch. Democrats and Republicans getting together with the president to talk about healthcare, and he put his plan on the table for all to see yesterday. You can get all the details if you go to the White House webpage, but of course the summary of it is all over the news today as well. We have two guests with us who have different perspectives on this issue. We're speaking, and we'll reconnect with him in a moment. Thomas Miller with the American Enterprise Institute will be joining us. Paul Starr joining us later, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, co-editor of the American Prospect, and he worked to help put together the Clinton health care reform package back in the 1990s. I think you were in mid-sentence. I don't know if you even know what sentence you were in. Your phone just evaporated, Thomas.
Well, that's all right. All the sentences start to converge. It's the limits of it shouldn't have been bad cell phone reception, so blame my carrier.
Okay.
I'm back on for good or bad for the audience.
No, for good for the audience. Let's look at this premium going up, coinciding with the news of this week and the bipartisan meeting. We've got the California Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield raising, increasing premiums 39%. Boy, there were sad stories on the news last night about that. Do we need legislation to deal with that? Do you think the president's plan would, well, it would, in terms of having a review committee, look at increases in premiums that may not be justified?
Well, the headlines are certainly terrible, and they get exploited. It's a gift that keeps on giving for those who want to pound insurers. I could get into the more elaborate details as to what's behind that rate increase, which there are peaks where they're 39%. Most of the evidence indicates the average in what is about 10% of the California market is 24% for one of the major carriers, which has about 30% of it, which is Anthem of California Blue Cross plan. Basically, their costs went up. You can't hide that. We go through this all the time with different types of insurance rate increases. It's worked in other areas of insurance as well, where we need to change the cost structure, and some of it was because people moved around and only more expensive people were staying in the individual market. And California has a lot of economic problems on top of that. But insurers have to stay in business. It's not a matter of large profits, although you can play games with kind of what the profits were last year, somewhat exaggerating them. In general, insurers are not much more profitable than the average industry, and certainly a number of industries do more than that. But the costs went up in that particular part of the market, and unless you want to see insurers should sell premiums for less than what the actual costs were in a given year, it's kind of hard to get out of that box. We can have all kinds of rate-setting authority, and this happens in the states as well, but they can't run insurers out of business. What we need to do, though, obviously, is to bring down costs, both by encouraging healthier lifestyles, better practices, better delivery of care, and there might be a way to squeeze out some of the extra administrative costs in some cases in the insurance market and make it operate a little bit more efficiently and give people better informed choices. But this is, in effect, reflecting economic reality, and what happened with Anthem in California isn't significantly different from what's happening with a number of other insurers in other states, including a lot of nonprofit insurers, facing a bad economic environment. People who are pressed for money and are relatively healthy don't have insurance or don't have it offered to them, and they try to get by. It's not a perfect situation, but that's kind of the difficulties we're in. Until we restore economic growth and have those jobs coming back and the resulting benefits of that, it's a serious squeeze.
Let's go to phone calls. Victor from Oconomowoc. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning to your guests. How are you both?
Good. How are you?
Fine, thank you. I think the healthcare reform effort is indicative of, in a very good example, of the failure of leadership on the part of the Obama administration. I say this as someone who voted for Obama, who walked door-to-door for Obama. He has not provided, until now, almost a year after the effort began, a clear and concise message on healthcare. And a clear and concise message of no is very easy to understand. And that's the Republican message. It's very politically advantageous. Obama needed to, at the beginning, craft a clear message. And healthcare reform is ready-made, tailor-made, with easy ideas. Medicare for all. Sometimes the invisible hand needs a helping hand. All sorts of simple slogans could have helped sell this message to the public. And I just want to say that, you know, part of leadership is coming forward with a clear and concise message. But, you know, as Machiavelli said, it's better to be feared than to be loved.
Okay, Victor, thanks for your call. Tom?
Well, I understand the sentiments of the folks who are, supportive of what seemed to be the dream in 2008. However, I think you need to get a little bit further and realize that as much as there are complaints about the messaging and the way in which things were packaged, underneath it, the policy, the package itself, was not working and was not really there and didn't come together. There were enough Democrats in Congress to pass this if they didn't have problems both in their own minds and what they were hearing back in their home states. So it's not magic. The president's spoken on this a lot of times. He's given a lot of addresses and other types of approaches, all kinds of outreach. And sometimes you have a product that you try to sell in different ways, and it ultimately doesn't sell. Now, an answer of no is not the right answer, and that's there are Republicans who go beyond that. But until we first get off this page, recognizing that this package, this approach, reached too far, did it in the wrong way, and ultimately didn't go down with the public, we won't get to those answers that are buried within parts of this legislation that we still need to do. There are important things that are necessary as reforms, but we're kind of stuck because each side is in their own respective corner and hasn't found out that middle position, which is not the big grand thing, but is more than simply saying no.
Thanks, Victor, for your call. More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls now for Tom Miller. He's at the American Enterprise Institute, former senior health economist for the Joint Economic Committee. He studies healthcare policy and regulation. Jan from Sauk City. Hi.
Hi. I have two questions. First, I want to see some bipartisanship. But first of all, if small companies do they have to provide insurance? If and will they get fined if they don't? The second question is: Are insurance companies going to be allowed to charge more to people with pre-existing conditions so as to make them have to drop it? I was just wondering if your guests knew the answer to either of those. But again, I would like to see some bipartisanship. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Jen.
based this on what's in the White House adjustments to what was largely the last Senate-passed legislation. The small companies, although they increased the penalties on most employers for not offering coverage and having their employees either wander into the exchange and get subsidized coverage, or in the event that their premium cost would be greater than a percentage of their income. They only set that at about 8% of income. Those companies would have different penalties on them multiplied by their number of workers, but companies with below 50 workers are, at least in this iteration, exempt from that employer mandate. Whether that would change over time is a different story, and there's some small business tax credits, but they tend to expire pretty quickly after a little appetizer. In terms of charging more for individuals with pre-existing conditions, in the legislative version of this, it's to prohibit that. I didn't see any changes in the time in which that phases in, which tends to be a little in front of when the exchange-based coverage becomes available, and the Senate version is 2014, and I guess that's what they're still going with. There's a later stage approach to applying some of those rules on insurance premiums to the group market, particularly in terms of age rating, but that comes much later on, and there's some grandfathering in for a period of time for existing plans, but over time they'd all, I think it's in 2018, everybody would be operating under the same set of rules. Whether you could actually do that is a different story in what the effects would be. We could debate a bit in terms of what that may mean for premiums in a lot of these markets, but that's at least the opening offer on the face of it.
I think Jan speaks for a lot of people, Tom. Tell me if you agree when she says she expects and hopes for some bipartisanship on all of this, that the American people have had it with, you know, it being so divided.
Well, let me try to... Yeah, I understand that sentiment. Let me explain what I think is really going on. Sometimes our politics is a little volatile, and we're not sure what we exactly want. In the wake of the 2008 election, so it appeared there was this, you know, sweeping mandate, which got a little overinterpreted. A lot of Democrats got elected with, you know, big majorities in Congress. The president was elected. And so they thought they could do some things that maybe the public hadn't really focused on and signed off on, aside from get those other guys out, and we didn't like what happened, you know, the economy tanked, et cetera. So now we've had that the de facto majority has actually changed in the countryside, but we still have these big numbers in Congress, and there's a mismatch. And I suspect that if we can, you know, find out where the country really is, maybe this fall in the next round of congressional, and that's the Republicans are going to take over the House and the Senate, but we'd find a little bit more of a working balance where neither side, you know, both sides know they can't get what they wish, but they have to work together a little bit more in balance with where the public essentially is. And I think that's why running this through right now with what appears to be temporary control for something this massive and sweeping is just not politically sustainable and is out of touch with where the public mood is, which is a different balance than either party is currently offering.
One more call for you, Jeff from Winneconne. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. You know, the reason why Obama took so long for this health care bill is to try to expose the Republicans for who they are. They're a bunch of bums. A majority wants this plan. They want the a public option. I don't know where your guest is coming from, but the majority definitely wants this health care bill.
Do you think that a majority want a public option, Tom?
No, I mean, there's always soft things where just like a majority for a moment will say it'd be great to control prices and it'd be great to, you know, have someone offer me something for nothing. But if you look at the broader mix of all the legitimate, extensive national opinion polls, and some will twist a little bit to make it like an even balance, it's been pretty predominant over the last 3 months or longer that the majority has turned against this. Now, sometimes it's a plurality, but there's just not that support for doing something on this scale. Sure, people would like to have the problem solved. They'd like to have it go away. They'd like to have a lot of promises answered. But when you drill down and ask them the next question, well, what if it means this? What if it means that? All of that soft support for these nostrums disappears. The public, which is sometimes confused and a little bit, you know, ambivalent and complex, has not seen what it wants currently.
So your prediction before we let you go, if you care to give us one, what's going to happen on Thursday?
A showtime for the cameras, not quite a steel cage match of wrestling style.
It will be interesting.
Each party posturing appropriately. The president hoping to set a trap for the Republicans by making them look like they're brain dead and have nothing to offer and are just obstructionists. The Republicans saying you haven't actually listened to the public and, in fact, you're offering the same thing rewarmed over again. And then we'll have some flailing efforts to try to run this through the Senate and the House through the reconciliation measure. If I had a guess right now, and guesses are, you know, as good as the next day, I think they're going to actually have more trouble in the House than in the Senate in getting it through. But they don't have the votes currently to do this. They didn't have the votes a month ago. The Massachusetts thing certainly probably upended it even more thoroughly. So they're trying to thread a needle. And, you know, the backstop is to say, well, at least we've got a campaign issue and the Republicans stop this. But that's not a very satisfactory place for the Democrats.
Thank you, Tom. We'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Thank you. Tom Miller, our guest, this first half hour resident fellow of the American Enterprise Institute. We continue our conversation. Still welcome phone calls. We hear another perspective now from Professor Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect. He holds the Stewart Chair in Communications at Public Affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School. He received the 84 Pulitzer Prize for Nonfiction for The Social Transformation of American Medicine, and in 2005 an award for the creation of the media. He's written extensively on American society, politics, and domestic and foreign policy, and he wrote a book in 92, The Logic of Healthcare Reform, which laid out the case for a system of universal health insurance and managed competition. He was a senior advisor at the White House in 1993 in the formulation of the Clinton health care plan. We're continuing phone calls. We're just getting our guest on the line, and we'll be welcoming more emails. I'm sorry we didn't get to those yet, but we will during the course of this half hour. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And again, our phone number is 800-486-8655. Professor Paul Starr, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
Well, a lot of people are saying, the New York Times at least is saying, where was the president? Why did we just get his plan yesterday?
Well, he was holding back because of the lesson that many people had drawn from the Clinton experience when the White House prepared an elaborate plan, and some members of Congress felt their toes had been stepped on. So Obama held back this year. And really, it would have been a great success had the House and Senate been able to move more quickly and reached agreement before January 19th.
Mm-hmm. We were talking yesterday with the Washington correspondent for the CBC, and we were looking at healthcare because we're all watching the Olympics this week. And she was just astounded how contentious this issue remains in the United States when it was her feeling that Canada pretty much has it all worked out. Why is it so contentious for such a long period of time, and it keeps getting more so?
Yes, it is one of the distinctive aspects of healthcare in the United States. It's not just that we're the only advanced country in the world without universal health coverage that doesn't cover all its citizens. We're also the country in the world where the politics are the most contentious, the most vicious. And really, there's a striking difference this year from earlier episodes. This is an issue that Americans have been debating and fighting about for nearly a century. In the past, however, it was chiefly interest groups, originally the doctors, then later the insurance companies and small business groups, that were opposed to health care reform, and they often fanned the ideological flames over the issues, working with conservative groups. This time around, the situation really is a bit different. Most of the interest groups have either supported reform or they've been sitting it out. The opposition this time is entirely partisan and ideological.
Well, even the AMA, there was an article I was reading a couple of days ago saying, you know, they'll be disgusted if there isn't some kind of reform. And certainly in past years, they haven't been as supportive.
Yes. Oh, yes. And really, it's true of these other groups as well. And I think it's because they recognize that the system as it's set up now is unsustainable. I mean, you take a look at one lobby that back in 1993 was fiercely opposing health care reform, and that was the small business lobby, particularly the National Federation of Independent Business. They have been actively involved in the negotiations. Now, they haven't supported the final legislation, but it's really quite conceivable that they could. And that's a huge change from 16 years ago.
Mitch McConnell suggested yesterday, and others have, and even some Democrats have, why not do this thing in an incremental way? You look at the complexity of what the president, because, you know, these things aren't very simple, and I think that many of us would like them for us to be a little more clear-cut. Why not take one of these at a time? You do something about the uninsured. You do something about denying for pre-existing conditions. You do something about help for small business. Then we can all look at each part of this and say, okay, we're for this, or no, we don't really like this.
It just doesn't work. The problem is that the parts are too interconnected. So let's take something which almost all Americans agree on. We should get rid of the exclusion of pre-existing conditions. Americans hate that aspect of health insurance. But if you did that alone, what would happen? Well, people who were healthy would very reasonably decide not to buy insurance because they could get it whenever they got sick. And the result would be that the entire insurance system would break down because it doesn't work unless healthy people as well as sick people pay into it. You just can't eliminate the pre-existing condition exclusions and not do the next step. The next step is what's called guaranteed issue and a mandate. That is, you have to require the insurers to issue a policy, and you have to have some strong incentive or requirement for people to participate. Well, the last time I was on your show, you had a caller who forced me to think about this whole issue of the mandate more carefully. And after that show, I made a new proposal on this.
Really?
Which I want to tell you about. This, the caller, perhaps she's listening now, said, well, you know, if they're going to require me to buy insurance, they might as well come and lock me up. They might as well hand me off to jail because I can't pay for it. And I tried to explain that, well, there are these subsidies in the bill that would make insurance much more affordable for her. And I could have said some other things. For example, there is a financial hardship exception. If the cost of the least expensive plan is more than 8% of your income, then you can just check off a box and say it's too expensive, mm-hmm. and you don't have to pay a penalty. But there are penalties in the law, and it occurred to me there's another way to do this. What we're really concerned about is preventing people from opportunistically not buying insurance when they're healthy and then dipping into the insurance funds when they're sick. And there is another way to get around this. And the idea comes actually from the German health insurance system. The proposal would be this. If you don't want to participate, you can opt out. The thing is, you won't be able to opt back in whenever you'd like. And so what I've proposed is that there be an opt-out. You can just sign a form saying you don't want to participate. You won't be subject to any penalties. But for the next 5 years, you'd be ineligible for federal health insurance subsidies. So people would have to think very carefully, do I want to take that risk? Do I want to be completely outside this system of subsidized insurance? And I think it would be a way to make the whole proposal a lot more acceptable to people who object in principle to the idea of a federal requirement for insurance.
Is that in the president's plan, Paul?
No, it isn't. It's an idea that I've written about, I've circulated, I've got some interest in it. Interestingly, the support for it comes from the left and the right.
Hey, there you go. That's good. That's not much of that is happening these days, is it?
Yeah.
Tell me about the president's strategy. Has he done a brilliant thing here? There's going to be so huge an audience, I think, for C-SPAN on Thursday. I know I want to watch as much as I can. Has he backed Republicans into, you need to present a plan so that we can look at your plan, we can look at my plan, and we'll come up with something? Is he planning on embarrassing them? Is he planning on reconciliation? What's his strategy?
Well, I think he wants to bring out the differences between the Democratic and Republican approaches to the problem. he wants people to focus on what is the substance of these ideas, because the whole debate has gotten so distracted by things that are really not central to it. And what a lot of public opinion polls have shown is that support for the Democrats' proposal grows the more information people have. So I really think the central issue here is for the president, for the Democrats, is to focus on the substance. I don't think it's a matter of embarrassing the Republicans. I think the Republicans will come well prepared. They will defend their position. I don't know whether they'll have anything new to offer. I kind of doubt it. The Republicans in the House did have a proposal that they offered as an alternative, and the Congressional Budget Office, which does these estimates for both Democrats and Republicans, estimated that the number of uninsured, which is now at about 17% of the population, would also be 17% once the Republican proposal was fully enacted. So, I don't think they're really prepared to do all that much about that aspect of the problem, and the cost containment measures are also very weak. So I think the president feels, the Democrats feel, they will benefit the more people focus on the substance.
Mm-hmm. The previous guest from the American Enterprise Institute said that he thought that the president's plan would stand a rough chance of passage in the House. Do you agree?
It's a tough call right now. It's a very tough call. The key group consists really of the anti-abortion Democrats, perhaps about 10 of them. I think they're the ones who hold the balance of power in this. And the question is whether they will be satisfied by the language in the Senate bill regarding abortion coverage. And I think they ought to be satisfied. I think looking at this really from the standpoint of their own values, they are going to get something in this legislation which doesn't exist, which would limit abortion coverage. I'm not in favor of that myself, but I think actually if they look at this coolly, from the standpoint of their own values, they will vote for it.
Let's go to calls. Jim from Pleasant Prairie. Hi.
Good morning. And, first of all, I'd like to state that personally I'm not into partisan politics. I appreciate the guest's historical overview, but unfortunately it comes down to that nasty science called politics. And I think the previous guest made a very good point that if the Democrats were harmoniously on key, the Republicans wouldn't even matter in this situation. You'd already have a signed bill that would be, ready to implement into law. Republicans, in order to do well in the fall, simply have to remind the public that, remind the country that they are the loyal opposition, and the government is controlled both on the executive level and the legislature level of both houses by the Democrats. And so they'd be foolish to get involved in a direct debate because it's really not theirs to control.
Well, I do think that the opposition party has a responsibility to offer constructive proposals. And I do think it's a count against the Republicans in this debate that they really haven't engaged the issue substantively. No, the caller is right. I mean, if the Democrats could achieve unity on this, they could pass the legislation. The Democratic Party, however, is really it's a much more heterogeneous party than the Republican Party. There used to be liberal Republicans. There used to be a fair number of moderate Republicans. There really aren't that many of them left in the Congress. It's a much more uniformly conservative party. The Democrats, on the other hand, really extend. I think if you look at this in terms of the voting patterns, you've got a lot of Democrats in the South and the West who are more towards the center. And it's hard to hold them all together.
Sure is. Thanks very much, Jim, for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about... Yes, healthcare reform. How many shows have we done? Quite a few. This Thursday, the big day, the Republicans, the Democrats, the president meeting at Blair House to put plans on the table. And we'll see what happens. We're looking at specifically the president's plan, which was released yesterday, and the politics behind all of this. And certainly our guest knows about the politics and the plans. Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. He wrote a book, The Logic of Healthcare Reform, in 1992, which laid out the case for a system of universal health insurance and managed competition. In 93, he was a senior advisor at the White House in the formulation of the Clinton Health Plan. Our number is 800-486-8655. We'll take an email or two following this on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, the author of The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life of Frances Perkins, FDR's Secretary of Labor and His Moral Conscience. This woman was just a real trailblazer, and it is amazing when you look at the number of pieces of legislation that she suggested needed to be a part of the New Deal and subsequently became a part of the New Deal. Plus, her life is quite extraordinary. Kristen Downey, a frequent contributor to the Washington Post, used to write a jobs column for the Post, is the author, and she will be with us hour number two. All right, let's go to a couple emails here. This comes from Karen from Platteville. The skyrocketing price, Paul, of healthcare will consume our entire budget if we do nothing. Isn't this a security issue if it threatens our ability to function as a superpower? If the Republicans aren't willing to step up and do what is right, is it not the responsibility of the majority Democrats to make sure that something is done under the constraints of the Constitution?
All right. Well, I do agree with that. And in fact, I think this is really one of the driving forces behind healthcare reform. It's not just a matter of the uninsured. It is a matter of healthcare consuming an increasing portion of the nation's income, an increasing portion of our taxes at the federal and state level. We are now up to 17.3% of the national income going to healthcare. That is dramatically more than any of the other rich democracies. 9%, 10%, 11% of the typical patterns in other countries. This is hundreds of billions of dollars more in the United States. And yet, we have all these millions of people uninsured. We do worse on measures of health, longevity. The performance on many specific aspects of healthcare is worse. It doesn't really make any sense that we're spending so much more and getting less.
Diane from Milwaukee. Hi.
Oh, good morning.
I can't hear you, Diane.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I wanted to talk about what they're doing about drugs. I'm on Part D.
Mm-hmm.
And my prescription, my generic, went up from $15 to $32.50.
Ooh.
That's more than 100%. My name brand drug went from $92.50 last year to $170.
Mm.
Now, is there going to be anything done about prescription drugs to make them, you know,
more affordable? There is something about prescription drugs in the Obama plan, Paul.
Well, yes, the donut hole, that area where coverage stops, is going to be closed up, and so people on Medicare Part D, will have better protection against high drug costs. I don't know enough about the specific issues affecting the caller, so I can't comment about that. I don't know what the drugs are, it's not my area of expertise. But there is an effort here to help out the elderly who have high prescription drug costs.
Those costs have gone up substantially for Diane. That's a huge increase.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks for your call, Diane. Let's go next to David from Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
Yeah, just 2 points. I like your idea about if you opt out, you can't opt back in. But another way of getting around that, mail everyone in America a check that will pay for the least expensive health care. You know, if I got a check in the mail that I could use to only use to buy health care, I mean, why wouldn't I? Then make all the insurance companies offer a basic health care plan. And instead of having the politicians decide what it covers, let the Surgeon General, let the medical care community design this basic health care plan. And then just tell all these insurance companies, you have to offer it, no turning people away. You set one price. You know, and everyone would get the same. Different companies would be different prices, but it's sort of like when I go to Walmart to buy a Coke and you go to the same store to buy the same bottle of Coke, we pay the same price.
Professor Starr.
Okay, well, in the law would set up health insurance exchanges where people who now buy insurance individually or through a small business would have pretty much just the opportunity that the caller is talking about. That is, health insurance would be offered at a single price. There'd be some variation for age, but much less so than exists in the current marketplace. And indeed, there would be a basic plan. There'd be plans at various levels from the various insurers. So I think the legislation is trying to achieve what the caller wants. Now, we're not sending everybody in America a check to pay for it. Some people can pay for the insurance themselves. So the law is set up so that it would subsidize people who are under or near the poverty line, and then have subsidies for people up to four times the poverty level. It kind of phases out as people's incomes increase. And the aim here is to keep the cost of health insurance below a certain level of your income. And that depends on the income level. So at the very lowest level, near, you know, it's about 1.5 times the poverty level, people would pay 2 or 3% of their income, and it goes up to a maximum of about 8 or 9%. That's the way the law is working. You know, I know this is complicated, but I think actually, if people could understand how this affects them, they'd see that, you know, a lot of them are having trouble paying for health insurance, would be in much, much better shape.
Well, how do you deal with the complexity of all of this, Professor Starr? Because we, for whatever reason, yeah, don't seem to have the will to understand or the time to understand the complexity.
You know, the thing is, our current system is phenomenally complex. We have countless numbers of different insurance plans with different benefit packages that lead to a tremendous amount of excessive bureaucracy. It would be terrific if in one stroke we could simplify the whole system, but you just can't do that because the opposition would be tremendous. So what I think they're trying to do is to take things step by step toward a simpler, cleaner system, and the insurance exchanges are the key to this. These are already up and working in Massachusetts. They exist in the Netherlands and various other countries. It's really a simple idea, and that is to give people who now buy insurance individually or through small businesses the advantages that people have who get insurance through a big company. And so the exchange would, in effect, be a group purchaser for all those individuals and small businesses. And everybody in the exchange would get insurance on the same terms. No pre-existing condition exclusions, no pricing according to your health. So people who now have chronic illnesses or disabilities who can't afford health insurance because of the way the whole market works, they would find now that the system worked for them.
I see. Thanks, David, for the call. Gary is next from Madison. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I have a very simple point here. Why don't they just fix whatever is wrong with Medicare, extend it to everyone, bill accordingly to fund it, and then if people want more, let them have the supplemental insurance. It's very simple, similar to what we have now. It's already been accepted. So I'd like to hear a comment on that.
All right.
Well, that idea has come up at various times, but essentially, you know, if you took Medicare and you applied it to everybody, you'd have to raise a lot more money in taxes. There are a lot of people who like their current insurance. You'd have a huge problem with the doctors and the hospitals because Medicare pays 20% to 30% less than does private insurance, and in effect, you'd be reducing the revenue into the healthcare system an enormous amount with one stroke, and it would create chaos.
What do you think? I have to ask you to predict what you think, and then what you hope will happen at this meeting on Thursday.
I guess what I expect is that each side will run through its argument. I'm not sure how much real deliberation there will be, real engagement of one with the other. I think they're both going to be very well prepared, very, very good at doing it, and it should be worth watching. Of course, what I hope is that there could actually be some room for common ground, but I just don't see it. Let me just say one historical thing. You know, the Democratic proposals rely on private insurers, and in that respect, they go back to Republican proposals. They go back to the proposals that Richard Nixon and various other Republicans made back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. So, substantively, the Democratic proposals are bipartisan. They're just a bipartisan compromise with a Republican Party that no longer exists. This Republican Party just is so far from the Democrats on this issue that I don't see how they can come together.
Are you going to watch all day?
Well, I'm going to watch as much of it as I can, given my other obligations.
Yeah, I am too. Thank you so much. You're a great guest. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our guest this half hour, Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs, Stewart professor of communications and public affairs at Princeton, co-editor and founder of the American Prospect. Also a great guest, Tom Miller, resident fellow of American Enterprise Institute. We thank Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing this excellent show, and Connor O'Brien for doing our on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have more coming up following the news on the Ideas Network.